mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today on the 80th anniversary of D-Day, the Library of Congress wants to preserve the firsthand history of those who were there for the most significant day of what is arguably the most significant conflict in world history. Also this morning in our Throwback Thursday, the first wave bringing to life the stories of those Americans who led the way to victory in World War II on the beaches of Normandy. And for young readers, the I Survived book series brings the historical significance of the Allied invasion to a new generation. And the transition of Hancock County's recycling program from an in-house operation to Rumpke of Ohio is underway. Operations Manager Courtney Comstock explains what residents can expect over the coming weeks. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Thursday, June 6th, 2024. So every day there's got to be something that we are worried about and fearful of. And a couple of these stories jumped out at me on the newswire. And you ever have that happen where you go and read your news feed? You know, you scroll on your mobile device or on your computer and you know, the news stories pop up, and some of them just immediately jump out at you. This was one that jumped out at me this morning. It says, a rarely seen and extremely endangered species of rattlesnake is still present in Ohio. ODNR, the Department of Natural Resources, says an eastern Massasauga rattlesnake. Eastern Massasauga rattlesnake was recently spotted by researchers and volunteers who are participating in an annual snake survey in the state of Ohio. The species is just one of three rattlesnakes present in Ohio, along with the eastern copperhead and timber rattlesnake. And all are obviously very important to the ecosystem. And this is an endangered species, the eastern Massasauga rattlesnake. Extremely endangered, but we still have them. So it's kind of good for the ecology, not necessarily something that the rest of us want to hear. Got to worry about this rattlesnake in Ohio. But what was interesting on the story is officials are not saying where the snake was found. They documented the snake was captured for measurements and then released back into the wild, and they are not saying where. They're concerned that people, you know, poachers might go and kill the snake for its skin, which is one of the ways that it became endangered in the first place. So they're not saying what. I want to know. I want to know. Correct me if I'm wrong. Don't you want to know where the snake is? I think I would want to know. Give me at least a general area beyond just somewhere in the state of Ohio. Ohio's a big place. I think we need to know, generally speaking, where this is. But anyway, if that's not enough to be worried about, we have these giant flying spiders that are coming, making their way through, that are invading the United States. Giant flying spiders. They're called the Joro spider. It is an invasive species. They are native to Asia, and currently they have been documented heading up the east coast of the United States. These spiders are unique in that they can use silk threads to form kind of a parachute and fly through the air. We've got giant flies, and these are like the size of your hand, from what I understand. This is a big spider, a big flying spider is invading the U.S. Now, they say, don't worry, the Joro spider is fairly harmless. Interesting they use the word fairly harmless. The spider can bite, but the venom is pretty much ineffective. Pretty much. I love the way they use these terms. It's fairly harmless. The venom is relatively ineffective. Most humans and pets do not have a reaction to the venom. It's too weak. So we don't have to worry, apparently, outside of the fact that it is a huge flying spider. apparently, this has been around for a while. It was first spotted in the U.S. around 2010, but now it is spreading up and down the East Coast and heading for New York. Wow. We've got rattlesnakes. We don't know where they're at. And we've got these giant flying spiders. What more? What more? Oh, my. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started. Do you remember when you were a kid collecting those Star Wars action figures? I remember, what was it, like Christmas 1977, 78, was everything Star Wars under the tree. And I saw this story and it immediately, again, jumped out at me. A rare Star Wars action figure has sold at auction for a record-breaking $525,000. Most ever paid for one of those action figures. Heritage Auctions announced earlier this week that the Boba Fett action figure sold on May 31st is now the world's most valuable vintage toy. The most valuable vintage Boba Fett action figure. And when I saw that, the reason that jumped out at me is I had one of those Boba Fett action figures. I remember, I can see it in my mind. I had those Boba. Well, yes, you may, as it turns out, you may have had a Boba Fett action figure in your younger days, but you did not have this one. This one was from 1979. It was a rocket firing Boba Fett, came with little plastic missiles. But the toy never hit the shelves because it was determined that the missiles could become choking hazards because they're very small parts. So they never put them on the market, which was probably a good idea. But some of the toys survived. Most of them ended up in a recycling bin or, you know, were destroyed. But some of the toys survived and have been in high demand by collectors. And that's what this was. So you may have had a Boba Fett action figure, and you look at this and say, man, I wish I still had mine. I could be rich. No, you really couldn't. The one you had was not this one. By the way, the winning bid for this action figure broke the record for a vintage toy, as we mentioned, previously held by a diamond-wearing Barbie doll that sold for over $300,000 back in 2010. So now it is the most valuable vintage toy out there. Kind of interesting. I saw this story I thought was really interesting. One of those things that make you go, hmm. There is a tribe in the Amazon rainforest, the Marubo tribe, that is very isolated. I mean, that's a part of the world that, you know, the modern, modern society kind of remains untouched by modern society. At least it had remained untouched until 9 months ago. That is when the Starlink internet service was launched and came to this remote area of the Amazon forest. And the Marubo tribe was initially pretty excited for the first time they would be able to access the internet. Again, this was 9 months ago. But now, not everyone agrees that this has been a good thing for their community. One of the members of the tribe, Alfredo, says that young men in Marubo have been sharing adult content and have become more aggressive. They also he said they also don't even talk to their own family because they are so addicted to internet porn and social media. If there was ever a question that the internet, I mean, for all of it, the good things that it has brought to us, that there are some significant downsides to the internet. Check this out. The Marubo tribe in the most remote part of the Amazon rainforest. In just 9 months, they have gone from, you know, the centuries of life that they have known the millennia of life that the tribe has known, to a society addicted to social media and online porn. Everyone is so connected that sometimes they don't even talk to their own family anymore. And they've actually had to bring in mental counselors to get these young people back, you know, focused on real life. They want to maintain their traditions, but the internet has made it darn near impossible, according to one of the tribal leaders. Say all the young people want to do is spend the entire day on their phones. So leaders of the Marubo tribe have now put screen time limits in place. Does that sound familiar? That is crazy to me. 9 months of making the internet available in one of the most remote places in the world, and it's already, the internet has already done its thing. So it doesn't take long. And finally, this morning, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This is really kind of interesting. A new survey, and this is out of the UK. We think of, and we were talking about yesterday or the day before, you know, the wonderful traditions of summer. You go swimming. But what if you don't know how to swim? A new survey of 2,000 adults in the UK finds 28% of adults can't swim. And 25% never learned how to ride a bicycle. What? How crazy is that? 25% can't even ride a bike. 22% said that they wanted to learn how to ride a bike, but now they feel like it's too late to do so. 16% say they were scared to fall off the bike. 14% admitted to feeling too embarrassed to try and learn now that they are all grown up as an adult. It would be too embarrassing to bicycle lessons or swimming lessons as an adult. That's, how crazy is that? Anyway, it's kind of interesting. I didn't point that out. Just be glad that we can enjoy all of those, you know, great summer activities, because apparently a lot of folks can't. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather, partly to mostly sunny today with a high in the upper 70s. Partly cloudy tonight, a low around 60. The Findlay Police Department says officers responded to a hotel along Tiffin Avenue after receiving a 911 call from a woman saying she had been strangled to the point of unconsciousness by her boyfriend. As officers were interviewing the victim, another officer tried to pull over a pickup truck that was driving recklessly on Tiffin Avenue near Bright Road. The pickup truck lost control and crashed on Bright Road near Shore Boulevard. The driver, later identified as the boyfriend, fled the crash on foot. The pursuing officer deployed a taser on the man, subduing him and placing him under arrest. The 31-year-old was booked at the Hancock County Jail on kidnapping, strangulation, and other charges. Get more in the story on our website. Figuring out ways to better treat mental health patients in Ohio jails is one of the goals of the annual Mental Health and Addiction Conference.
There is a state working group looking into how jails work with mental health hospitals.
One of the challenges is that our jails still many times house people who have mental health problems, and our jails are not really designed to be able to deal with those individuals.
Ohio is also part of the Stepping Up initiative targeted at reducing the number of people with mental illnesses in jails.
ONN's Yolanda Harris reporting. A life-changing moment for a Findlay family as the dedication ceremony was held on their Habitat for Humanity home.
2, 1, welcome home! Woo!
The home on Logan Avenue is for Talisha Balicki and her two daughters. Talisha says she's thankful her family now has a place to put down roots and create memories. Habitat for Humanity of Findlay Hancock County will have another home dedication ceremony in a few weeks. Get more in the story on our website. The Hancock Historical Museum in Findlay will be holding a book sale today through Saturday. The museum says you can enjoy food from local vendors each day while browsing a variety of reference books and other historical works. Get more information on the book sale in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online at WFIN.com.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. Your task will not be an easy one, but the tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Well, today marks the 80th anniversary of D-Day, the most significant single day of what is arguably the most significant conflict in world history. Now, the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress wants to add the stories of those who were there to the Our Voices exhibit of World War II. Travis Bickford is head of program coordination and communications for the Veterans History Project. First of all, Travis, explain what the Veterans History Project is for those who may not be familiar.
So the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress was created back in 2000 as a national effort to collect, preserve, and then most importantly, make accessible the firsthand accounts and memories of our nation's veterans stemming from World War One to current day.
So this is obviously about more than just World War Two, but obviously there's some urgency with respect to World War Two veterans.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're losing, we're losing them every day, and there's not, many left, but they're still out there, and there's a lot of them that are very sharp and ready and capable to give their story. But that's not the only way that we can, that you can contribute and that's not the only, those aren't, oral histories aren't the only stories that we collect. We collect stories in the form of original photographs, letter correspondence, journals, diaries, anything in that kind of two-dimensional form, right, that speaks to the veteran's service, we can accept as long as it meets our criteria.
And why is this so important when there is so much that has already been documented about, in this case, D-Day?
And that's a great question. And, when you look back at history, often history is told through, through someone else's lens, right? And there's some kind of level of interpretation there. But that's, at the Veterans History Project, we kind of eliminate that, right? Because you get to hear it from the people who are actually there. You're listening to their story. And, that's what we do. We provide an opportunity for someone like Captain Richard Ware, for his family to be able to honor his legacy by preserving it for posterity at the Library of Congress when Captain Ware he disembarked from a boat and during the first wave 80 years ago to this day, and he didn't even make it to the beach. Mm-hmm. But yet we still have his story. You can still hear his story and so many others. And I think on a day like today, I think you owe it to them and yourself to get on our website, loc.gov/vets, and listen to one of those stories.
Yeah, I was going to mention, this is not a new project. We've actually talked about the Veterans History Project in the past. How many collections do you have from veterans who took part in the D-Day invasion?
It's hard to say. It's hard to pinpoint it because so many veterans participated on other levels, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, not everyone just stormed the beach, of course, right?
Right.
So they might list them, so the search for that it could be difficult. You can look up Normandy, though, and could get a pretty general sense. But we have about 65,000 stories from World War II veterans alone.
Explain what happens to these stories once they are collected. As you mentioned, it's not just audio stories. There are diaries, there are journals, there are letters. What happens to all of this material once it is collected?
Well, they get handled and preserved and taken care for by some of the best in the world at that, at preservation. That's if you send us something, that's one thing I guess the Library of Congress can guarantee, including the Veterans History Project, because we have archivists, people who work in preservation as well.
Yeah.
It's going to be, t- there's, it's going to, probably be the best care that you can imagine. I mean, it'll be taken care of. It'll be preserved, and there's no one better I know.
And again, as you were alluding to, not just preserved in the archives, locked away, but also shared in so many different ways. One of the wonderful things about our digital age is that we can share these things online while still preserving the actual documents, the audio files, and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. I mean, leave it up to the professionals, right? And they exist almost at every institution similar to ours, right?
Yeah.
But today's about the veterans. Today's about the veterans who served on June 6, 1944, 80 years ago. And again, I really encourage everybody to get online and listen to one of their stories.
And as you were saying, you know, it's learning about this on a different level because of the personal nature of the stories, where you get some of the details that maybe we don't know, those personal details that are not part of the, I guess, historical record, the traditional historical record. How can veterans and their families get involved?
Yeah, so you know, first thing, you know, locate who's that veteran in your life, right? You know, find that veteran in your life, or if you're having a hard time, if you don't have one in your life, I mean, you can go down to the local VFW. It doesn't matter. We have a field kit that you can download from our website that explains every detail of the process, from, you know, even gives you advice on how to find a veteran if you don't have a veteran in your life. It gives you every imaginable, all the imaginable information you need. But also, if you still have questions, just email us or call us. We'll answer. We'll get back to you.
And again, to reiterate that it's not just audio stories, it's other mementos, personal, I guess, artifacts, for lack of a better term, because I know that there are some veterans, particularly as it relates to D-Day, who just don't want to talk about it even all these years later. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that their stories have to be excluded.
Right. No, I mean, we collect original photographs. We collect letter correspondence. I mean, when I talk about Captain Richard Ware, I'm at, you know, that was, he didn't survive D-Day. Mm-hmm. So his story is posthumous. Yeah, but we have the letters that he wrote back and forth with his wife. We have the original photographs. You know, we have journals and diaries of veterans. There's so many other ways that these stories can be told. And I just encourage everybody to look at our website, do the research, and see firsthand exactly how these stories can be told.
And it is so important that they be told and they be preserved. Again, Travis Bickford is head of program coordination and communications for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Mention once again the website where folks can learn more, see some of these stories, and learn more about how to share the ones of their loved ones.
Absolutely. You know, our website for the Veterans History Project's website is loc.gov/vets, V-E-T-S.
Travis, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
So this morning we are honoring and paying tribute to the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. Beaches of Normandy, June 6th, 1944, was the event that marked the beginning of the end of the reign of Nazi Germany and World War II in Europe. And 5 years ago, for the 75th anniversary, author and historian Alex Kershaw released a book called The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. Back in May of 2019, we spoke to him about that book. It is our first Throwback Thursday segment this morning. Your books are known for telling unique stories from a unique perspective, but D-Day is such a well-known event. So much has been written about this already. What is there to add that hasn't already been documented?
Well, it's a very good question. I don't think there's a great deal to add apart from developing personal stories and really going into the personal detail, trying to bring out the human drama. So what I tried to do was to say, hey, unashamedly, I'm going to celebrate the 10 characters, 10 combat commanders who carried out the most difficult missions on D-Day. I'm going to show just what it took, and I'm going to go second by second in some cases and show the level of heroism, the sacrifice, the reality and brutality of war. I'm going to really unashamedly celebrate the guys who got the job done. So in some cases, you know, people will have come across the missions and some of the characters have been mentioned in other narratives, but not in the detail that I go into. And in fact, three or four of the characters are people that people have not read about before.
And what's interesting, and it really brings home the point, that these, you know, are not, they're not superheroes in army fatigues. These are average, ordinary people who did these extraordinary things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of them had never been in combat before. One of them, a guy called John Spaulding, who led the first Americans off Omaha Beach, had never fired a bullet in anger and yet achieved the almost unimaginable. Took Americans off the bloodiest beach on D-Day, where over 900 were killed. He did that first, the first American young combat leader to do that. So, yeah, I wanted to show that ordinary civilians can be thrust into situations where they have to wear a uniform and then lead others and can perform miracles.
And as we mentioned, you know, one of the things that your books are famous for is the perspective or the way that you tell these. So this is not a historical, just a historical text. This really, it's a narrative style, reads like a novel, even though it is nonfiction. And there's a specific reason for that.
Yes, because this is a fantastic story, and these are amazing people, and I think that most people do not want to read a long Wikipedia entry. They want to be entertained and told a story, and I think that, you know, America has always, the U.S. in particular, has always had a fantastic nonfiction narrative historians. David McCullough, people like Stephen Ambrose have done this very, very well. It's a, you know, I want people to keep turning the pages. I want it to be inspiring and moving, and I want people to actually feel like they're almost there. And that's the job. That's why.
And sometimes
that's why
you,
we do it.
And sometimes you have to remind yourself that it is not a novel; that it is, in fact, history. You know, real life history. You mentioned a couple of the individuals. Who are these D-Day warriors that you profile in this book?
First American to wade ashore on Utah Beach at 6:28, Leonard Schroeder, F Company, 4th Infantry Division, John Spaulding, John Strezik. The first American to put his boots on the ground in Normandy was a guy called Captain Frank Lilliman from upstate New York. They were all part of this first wave of combat commanders who really faced the highest stakes. They were most likely to die, so therefore the drama becomes even more intense. Not only are they most likely to be killed, but if they get killed, then failure ensues, and the mission is you know, doesn't work out. You know, they had to carry out these missions. If we hadn't succeeded, then D-Day wouldn't have been a success. So, high stakes, longest odds, most amount of courage.
Pretty incredible stories. How did you get all of this this information? I mean, you talk about the research that goes into telling these stories in such great detail.
Well, I've been walking the battlefield for over 20 years, and I lead battlefield tours for the World War II Museum. I was actually there just a week ago. So a lot of on-the-ground research. I've been lucky enough to have interviewed veterans for over 20 years. I wrote The Bedford Boys back in 2003. Mm-hmm. So that was the story of the most decimated unit on D-Day. A lot of kids from the small town of Bedford, Virginia were killed. 19 were killed in the first wave on D-Day. So I've been lucky enough, very privileged, to have met a lot of veterans and listened to them. I've been on the beaches themselves with first wave veterans. A lot of research, a lot of reading, and just, you know, being, but I think the biggest challenge was just being able to pick the key characters, pick the 10 guys that were going to be most fun and most moving to follow, most, where I could get some real depth, who had been interviewed at great length before, or who I could interview at great length, so that I could have that psychological and emotional depth. And it takes a lot, that, you know, because I want to put you in their minds, I want to put you in their hearts, I want them to have dialogue, I want you to actually to be there. So you do need a lot of research, a lot of material at hand to be able to bring those scenes to life, you know?
And such powerful stories and such a powerful event, as we mentioned, D-Day itself. You know, we're talking three quarters of a century after the fact. Talk about D-Day itself. I mean, what are your impressions about the significance of that event, not just in the obvious terms, I mean, what it meant strategically with respect to World War II, but with respect to global history overall?
Imagine if we'd failed and there was no plan B. So we would not have gone back had D-Day been a failure. And for about an hour on the 6th of June, 10, 11 a.m. on the 6th of June, it was pretty close to failing. We were considering pulling troops off Omaha Beach, which would have meant the invasion, from my point of view, would have been a disaster and would have failed. Mm-hmm. Pretty close, but no plan B. So if we had not succeeded on D-Day, then we would not have liberated Western Europe. We would not have gone back. And the likelihood would have been that we would have thrown all our resources and efforts into supporting the Soviets, who began to an unstoppable onslaught from the August of 1944 onwards, Operation Bagration, which is actually 10 times the size of D-Day. Yeah. So all of Western Europe would not have been freed. It would have been conquered by brutal communism, and we would have a very different world today. The fire of freedom, the flame of freedom would not have burned again in Europe, maybe even to this day.
Well, I tell you what, that is a very sobering thought on this 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. From May of 2019, our conversation with author and historian Alex Kershaw about his book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. You can read an excerpt from the book, learn more about it at our webpage. Go to goodmornings.net. Anyone who now, today, has any sort of meaningful recollection of World War II at all is at minimum 85 to 90 years old. And for years, we've been losing World War II veterans at an alarming rate. To bring this history, the history of this pivotal moment of D-Day, to a new generation and make sure that that history doesn't die. 5 years ago, Lauren Tarshis, author of the I Survived book series for young readers, released a title called The Battle of D-Day 1944 in honor of the 75th anniversary of that event. And from June of 2019, it is the second part of our Throwback Thursday this morning.
Explain the concept behind these books.
Sure, Chris. So what I do is I take an important event from history. It could be anything from the D-Day invasion to the American Revolution to even something way back in ancient Roman times like the eruption of Mount Vesuvius and the mm-hmm. destruction of Pompeii. I do tons and tons of research. I travel to all the places I write about. I interview experts. And then what I do is I weave a fictional story with a boy or girl that hopefully my readers can connect with, mm-hmm. and I fold that story inside the historical event. So the idea is to teach them a lot about history, but also create a story that even a kid who doesn't love to read is going to be really absorbed by.
Yeah, as you mentioned, past titles, I mean, you cover everything from, you know, ancient events to modern history. 9/11 was one of the titles, which, again, we forget that young people today have no recollection of that, even though it was relatively recent. How do you decide which events to craft these stories around?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention 9/11, because when I first thought of the series idea, I never imagined I would do anything like that. And I also never imagined that I would get so much mail, emails from kids and parents and teachers. So that event, which was right after I started writing the series, I wrote Titanic, then I wrote the shark attacks of 1916. I started getting deluged with mail from kids and teachers and librarians suggesting 9/11 as a topic, which I thought was kind of outrageous. But what I realized in talking to teachers and parents and, you know, these librarians was that there really was not a safe kind of story that was appropriate for young readers that would enable them to begin to learn about that event. Kids were curious. This mm-hmm. was 10 years ago when I started the series. Yeah. So many kids had been born into the 9/11 era. And so the mission of the series sort of shifted from just writing about exciting topics to writing about important events in a way that was appropriate for kids.
And this is not the first time the events of World War II have been the topic of the series.
Correct. That is that topic is of such, like, it's of such fascination to kids. So that I started right away when I started the series. I started getting a lot of mail asking for books about a book story about the Holocaust. So that's why I wrote the Nazi Invasion. I Survived the Nazi Invasion of 1944, which actually takes place in the woods of Eastern Europe and focuses on Jewish partisans who were fighting the Nazis during that time. Yeah. I wrote about Pearl Harbor. I actually wrote about the Hindenburg, which was one of my favorite in the series, the explosion of the Hindenburg, which happened right before World War II started. But yeah, if you look at that cover, you see that there is a Nazi flag on this Hindenburg airship.
Right.
So that also kind of touched on some of the themes of World War II.
So tell us about this story. The central character here is an 11-year-old boy in France who is called upon to help pull off the invasion.
Well,
in a sense,
he is a boy who his name is Paul, who's been living in a small village in Normandy, like many of the villages that I visited when I was researching the book. He has been living under Nazi occupation for 4 years. His father is a prisoner of war in Germany who was captured early in the war. His mother, unbeknownst to him, has been working in the resistance. He has no idea about this. The story opens on the day before D-Day, and Paul soon he discovers a American paratrooper trapped in a tree in a field near his house, which is based on real events from, again, from I spoke to survivors of the invasion in France who were children living in these villages the night when paratroopers started dropping from the sky. Many of them rescued them from trees or sheltered them in their homes. So Paul becomes, you know, pulled into these events and finds himself helping the paratrooper get to safety, finds himself in a nest of the resistance who are then and pulled into the front lines of this D-Day invasion so he can witness it. And then obviously so his recollection, what he's seeing can bring my readers up close to this event.
Yeah. Obviously, as we said, the goal is to make these real events interesting for children, get them interested in history on their level, and of course, reading about history, very important too. But ultimately, the stories are fiction, and I wonder if you've ever run into this. I mean, Hollywood films often get criticized for taking liberties with the facts when telling a historical story, and historical literary fiction is a pretty big concept for young readers. I mean, we have to emphasize to kids that that while the backdrop is real, the underlying story is fiction.
You bring up such a good point. I mean, even my fictional characters, anything that happens to them is based on a real, you know, something that I've encountered in my research. And we always also have expert readers reading the stories before, you know, a historian, et cetera, an expert on D-Day will read it. Because I want to make very sure that I feel this tremendous obligation to children to be presenting a factual story. So even though obviously, you know, my characters are fictional, anything that happens to those characters is based on real events. So I try, you know, and I think it's also an interesting thing that many of my books are used in classrooms. And I think historical fiction is a genre that teachers use, and they teach kids how to distinguish between the factual parts and, you know, the fictional elements of the character's world.
That is certainly.
So I think that's a really good point, and it's so important for kids to understand what they're reading.
Yeah. And to that end, at the end of the book, there is an entire section with more about the topic, in this case, D-Day, some discussion points and some actual history, unembellished history, again, at a kid's level for those who want to learn a little bit more about it.
Exactly. So when I finish the book, of course, these are short, you know, they're 100-page, you know, the story itself is short. So when I'm done, there's so much that I realize is kids are going to have on their mind. You know, something like, how did the D-Day invasion remain a secret when this was this vast, ambitious, you know, mission being planned over months with hundreds of thousands of people aware of it? How did they maintain the element of surprise? I wanted them to understand the timeline very carefully. I wanted them to understand that what it was, this is a part of a broader, you know, I did try to teach them a lot about World War II in the story so they have enough background to understand it. But there's so much else that I want them to understand. The other thing that I'm really trying to achieve in these books is I want to open the door for these kids
right.
so that they're going to want to go explore and learn on their own. These are fascinating topics. I want them to feel inspired to want to explore these really important topics.
Again, our conversation with Lauren Tarshis, author of the I Survived book series from June of 2019, with the book The Battle of D-Day 1944, released in honor of the 75th anniversary of D-Day. If you want to learn more about that book and the I Survived series, you can go to our webpage at goodmornings.net, and we have the link there. It is part of our Throwback Thursday this morning in honor of the 80th anniversary of D-Day.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Now, if you're a regular listener, you know that there seems to be a disproportionate number of broken news stories that come from the state of Florida. And it seems like they are constantly upping the ante, pushing the envelope, taking stupidity to the next level. Strange stuff. I mean, it seems like it's almost a point of pride in the state of Florida. And they've done it again. A Florida man by the name of Joseph Leedy allegedly crashed into the front of the Martin County Jail on Monday night, proceeded to throw rubber snakes at the jail, then poured motor oil onto his Toyota Camry and himself. And he did all of this while wearing only a woman's top. Woman's blouse. That's all he was wearing at the time that he did all of this. Medical crews attempted to sedate Mr. Leedy, but he seemed unaffected by the medication. According to Chief Deputy John Budensek, he kept joking and asking for more medication and laughing at the fact that we had to give him more medication. Mr. Leedy was taken to the hospital and then moved into the Martin County Jail, the same building he reportedly crashed into. He got to stay. And this appears to be his first arrest. He has no criminal record up until now. So he decided to, you know, go big or go home, I guess. If you're gonna make your first encounter with the law, make it a memorable one. That's right. Wow. must have been quite the... But, you know, for most of us, you would think, you know, that would be a first for these, you know, law enforcement officers. Never seen anything like it. In Florida, it's just another day. Just another day on the job. Let's see here. What else is going on in the broken news this morning? A North Carolina man, Franklin, North Carolina, Mike Wooten, his name, says he believes a large piece of debris that fell on his house may have come from outer space. Mr. Wooten heard a thump on his roof a couple of weeks ago and initially thought that maybe it was a bird, a large bird of some kind, maybe a crow or something. He soon found a mysterious object in his yard. Local news reporters say that this particular incident follows a similar discovery of debris about an hour north of Franklin. Both objects showed similarities like carbon fiber weaving and burnt titanium. Mr. Wooten has a hunch that the two pieces go together. The experience has also sparked speculation about the origin of the debris, prompting further investigation. He believes that it came from outer space. Anyway, maybe it fell off of the space station or something. Probably did not extraterrestrial in nature, but I guess you could say it. Terrestrial maybe came from outer space. That's crazy, though, isn't it? Find a chunk of space debris falling on your home. Thank goodness nobody was hurt. Weird. The city of New York is investigating one Harold Tischler after he was caught on video appearing to bribe a fire inspector with a pastrami sandwich. The inspector came to investigate a complaint regarding misuse of a propane tank. Mr. Tischler, who is running for city council in Brooklyn, can be heard in the recording offering a treat to the inspector, offering to treat the inspector to a pastrami sandwich at a local deli, complete with soda and pickles. my treat, he says, I'm buying. The inspector is in trouble, too, because he replied, if you're paying, I'll be there. Under city rules, offering someone anything, even a pastrami sandwich, is considered a bribe. And I read that story, and I was like, that's the guy, that's like the guy who walks into a crowded restaurant and tries to slip the maitre d' a dollar bill to move to the front of the wait line, you know? Hey, I got a dollar with your name on it. If you're going to bribe a fire inspector, pastrami sandwich, probably need more than a pastrami sandwich to get it done. You know what I mean? Make it worth my while. I don't know. This is a really sweet story out of Oregon, Baker County, Oregon. Story about a dog who traveled 4 miles to get help after his owner's truck crashed in a remote ravine there in Baker County. The truck missed a curve and went into the steep, brushy ravine. One of the man's dogs fled the scene and showed up at a camp where another where a family was staying at a campground, was barking and carrying on, and the family called police. Deputies then located Brandon Garrett's truck, providing first aid until medical crews arrived. Search and rescue crews had to use chainsaws to reach the vehicle. Mr. Garrett was brought out using a rope rescue system, so he was pretty far down in there. Probably would never have been found had the dog not gone for help. 4 miles the dog went to get help for his owner. Man's best friend. We don't deserve dogs. We do not deserve dogs. That is an awesome story. And finally, in the broken news this morning, this is how you know you are having a bad day. Well, it's a good day for this guy. Not so good for the other person in the story. Here it is. A man in Spain placed what he thought was a knockoff of a classic painting by French Impressionist Edgar Degas on an auction site. He thought he had a pretty good replica of the painting. So, you know, maybe someone would like to have this replica of this painting by a famous artist. Must have been thrilled to get $1,000 for it. $1,000 it went for. Wow! But his joy getting $1,000 for his painting was short-lived, because it turns out the artwork was purchased by a savvy art collector who recognized that it was not a knockoff, but a genuine Degas that had been missing for several decades, entitled Éloge du Magolac, something. I don't know what the title is. I'm not even going to attempt. The English version of the title, In Praise of Cosmetics. But it had been lost for several decades. And the painting is believed to be worth, now mind you, again, this savvy art collector paid $1,000 for it in an online auction. It is estimated to be worth $13 million. $13 million. Good for the buyer. But how would you like to be the man who who sold the painting valued at $13 million for $1,000 thinking it was a knockoff? That's how you know you are having a bad day. Oh, my goodness. Wow. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
It's the WFIN Virtual Car Show. Car Show Calendar and Ride Report. Show off your ride, whether it's two or four wheels.
Plus, find out where the rides and the shows are happening all in one place.
Just go to WFIN.com.
It's chrome and horsepower on display online. The WFIN Virtual Car Show Calendar, and Ride Report. Thanks to Details Auto Spa, Lorette Chevrolet Cadillac, Route 30 Harley-Davidson, and 1330 WFIN and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives, the power of online reviews. This was really kind of interesting. A new survey of 2,000 adults finds that Americans read, on average, 5 reviews before deciding on a product or service. 5 reviews on average. 34% say they place more weight on positive online reviews than on negative ones. Although, I think it's 13% say that they actually place more emphasis on the negative reviews over the positive, which is kind of interesting. 18% say they will not support a business that does not have an online presence. But I wonder, because the survey does not really delineate how they define an online presence. It seems like these days every business has an online presence. But that may be a website. It might be a social media page. It might be a Google presence, you know, the Google section of the business. Some businesses have all of the all of those things. But 18% will not support any business that does not have an online presence. 55% of Americans are more likely to give a small local business preference over a national chain. Although Dave Lehman of BirdEye conducted the survey, said for local businesses to flourish and remain competitive, they need to not only maintain a strong online reputation, but also be active on social media and deliver consumer experience, customer experience. And that is significant, because if you think that people these days just made up their minds, they, you know, read the online reviews, they make up their minds. Not so. 19% of those in the survey, only 19% say that they have found the best auto repair shop, one that they would trust implicitly and go to all the time. Only 19%. 13% have found the ideal therapist. So, and this goes across many different service lines, products and service lines. I just thought that was kind of interesting, the power of online reviews. How many reviews do you typically read before deciding on service, especially one that's going to cost you a lot of money? So the transition of Hancock County's recycling program from an in-house operation to Rumpke of Ohio is underway. And operations manager Courtney Comstock is with us this morning to explain what residents can expect over the coming weeks. This is something that has been in the works for many months. Mm-hmm. And we spoke a couple of three weeks ago with Commissioner Mike Pepple about, you know, how all of this came about and the reasons for this transition. So now this is getting started, and it's going to involve some changes for folks, most notably, and I understand this is what's happening now, you're replacing the recycling bins.
Yes, sir.
That are out there now.
Yep.
With new recycling bins. So talk a little bit about what's going on here.
So for many years, we have had the remote recycling access, where various locations throughout the community have seen the large blue bins that have the source separated containers, mm-hmm, that they can deposit their recyclables for a little bit more convenient location than the main
than
hub.
Than just Litterland.
Yes. Yeah. So what has been happening is we are coordinating with Rumpke for those units to be removed. So the blue units are going to be removed from various locations.
Okay.
And then our third-party contractor, which you're correct, is Rumpke,
right,
will be placing their recycling bins in place of the blue units.
So mostly at the same locations, right?
So far, everyone at the existing blue container locations, okay, has agreed to participate.
Okay.
So we're not seeing any major changes in that availability.
Okay.
What there may be seen is the delay in the switch. So the blue container needs to be removed and out of the way before Rumpke can come in with their containers. So there's a day or two of no containers.
Okay. So in the meantime, until the big blue containers disappear, can mm-hmm. people still put stuff into the big blue containers while they're there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We're a little bit behind getting those blue containers because we're trying to multitask in multiple different locations.
Yeah, there are quite a few of them out there.
Yes. There's about 17 locations, in which case, you know, as we are trying to coordinate everything between the multiple partners, mm-hmm. we have already implemented units at the recycling center there at the facility site at 1720 East Sandusky Street. So those containers are now 24/7. So that helps get used to what the containers will take, how to use the program, you know, and then when the unit is removed on the remote location within a few days, those smaller containers will be coming in. You'll see more units for use, not okay. just one unit.
And the biggest change when the new containers go in, people won't have to separate them the way they do, separate their recyclables the way they do with the big blue containers that they may be familiar with in the past.
Correct. Okay. Normally, all recyclables need to be separated out for processing. Rumpke has the abilities to collect a single stream process. Mm-hmm. And sort it at their facility. So yes, the resident itself doesn't have to have the multiple containers, which is what we really depend on
yeah.
at our small level. But with Rumpke, they're going to have equipment that can help source separate that on the end side. So the resident themselves will be able to single stream
yeah.
and put all of their unit, all their recyclables in one container.
It'll be done on the back end. And that's one of the benefits that Rumpke kind of brings to the table, being able to do that.
That is correct.
Yeah. And in the meantime, as you mentioned, there will be in this transition probably a couple of days here and there where there aren't containers. People should not just leave stuff there.
Please don't. We've yeah. actually had a couple of instances where people have left their materials because the container will be coming. However, that slows down the process. Now we're already dealing with the contaminations, and we don't want to start off on a bad foot. We right. want the community to respect and appreciate the program as they have for many years. Just because the container is getting a little bit of a different look doesn't mean that the recycling options aren't still there.
Yeah. So just kind of hold off until the new containers
yes,
are placed
please.
if there's not a container. Now, with respect to the locations of the containers, you mentioned the ones that are there kind of, I guess, on a permanent basis, for lack of a better term. Those will be mostly in the same, it appears they'll be in the same locations. What about the ones that are temporarily set up at different places? I know, for example, at my church, we have one that comes in every month, and we have a recycling site, but it's not there permanently. Will those still be done, or?
At this point, we're still into negotiations. However, okay. a lot of those temporary programs, it's more difficult for a company the size of Rumpke
right.
to do those individual pickup 2 to 3 times day services. We are trying to work with those organizations to see if they have the room and space. That is usually the issue with the temporary, is they don't have the space to accommodate 24/7, 365 days.
So theoretically, some of those could actually
become permanent,
regular permanent
yes.
Locations, given the smaller size
yes.
of the
actually,
bins.
A good example of that is First Presbyterian Church did agree to become a permanent location. So on the south end of Findlay, they have recycling containers. They were once a temporary one weekend a month,
mm-hmm.
and they are okay with becoming a permanent site. So you may see your availability with these programs increasing as well.
What happens to the old bins, the big blue containers?
Most of those bins are being outsourced or up for sale.
Okay.
Final destination of those units have not been decided yet, but I believe there is a process that the goal is to pretty much limit our inventory.
I mentioned that because obviously you're going to have to store them someplace, and you know, when people see them at places, you know, they can't be used, right?
Yes, yes. We've actually already had to relocate. We had a site in the city of Findlay that we were using for storage.
Just for storage.
Just for storage. Yeah. And it was becoming very popular of a
site.
Oh,
look, here's a recycling
bin. Oh, look, yes. Yeah. And you know, we understand the excitement of having a new location. However, that was not our game plan. So there took a little extra coordination to get those units removed to more clearly clarify that those were unavailable.
So this is all, you know, over the course of how many weeks is this going to take until all of these bins are placed? Is there a timeline on all of this?
The expected timeline is approximately, I want to say, about 2 weeks, depending on availability.
So this should all be done within the next couple of weeks. Maybe a bit of an inconvenience, you know, in the transition, but it should be done in a couple of weeks.
Yes, absolutely. The game plan is to have everything in place at the very latest by the end of June.
Okay, so with all of this happening, a couple of other questions that have come up on how the recycling program changes. First of all, is litter landing shutting down?
The facility, building, and staff will no longer be available once this process is complete.
Okay.
Staff will be relocated throughout other county offices, and those Rumpke containers will be available. So the site itself is still a main recycling hub for those collections.
Okay, but it won't be staffed.
That is correct.
Okay. And secondly, there are a number of special recycling days. We've got household hazardous waste. We've got tire recycling. We've got other things that have been done in the past. Will those continue to happen?
Yes, those are absolutely part of the EPA plan with the Hancock County Solid Waste District. So those will still continue. You will see some changes, obviously, with the litter landing facility no longer really being a feasible option for traffic.
Mm-hmm.
The increase of traffic with the containers and the heavy usage has required us to relocate the household hazardous waste event that we used to host there. But we are able to have that event at least on a monthly basis. We did kick that off last week and had our first event. We'll have one in June. We'll have one in July, August, and September. So there are four more events coming up that we can take advantage
of. And those will be held where?
The Hancock County Fairgrounds has agreed to help us with the spacing on that. So we'll come in off the Sandusky Street exit, go straight back through. There'll be signage available, and we can collect those household hazardous waste items on those days.
All right. So, again, just to kind of lay out how all of this is going to work, especially through this transition period over the next couple, 3 weeks or so as the bins are replaced. If folks have questions or are confused by any of this, what's the best way of getting those answers?
You can always call the Hancock County Commissioners. You can also call me at my office, which is at the Hancock County Solid Waste District. So it's the 419-7210 phone number.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's always email, Facebook, websites. You know, we're trying to get the information out there as much as possible. So even by simply emailing the Hancock SWMD, which is Solid Waste Management District, you can get the information and answer the questions.
All right. We've got a link on our webpage for more information about the recycling program locally and some of the changes that are coming. Again, Courtney Comstock with us this morning, kind of lay it all out for us. Courtney, thanks very much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. And our thanks to all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage, that of course, goodmornings.net, where you can also connect with us on social media, sign up for our daily email newsletter, and more. Bookmark our site and check back often, goodmornings.net. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. Catch you back here tomorrow.